Welcome to the London Property Podcast, your go-to source for navigating the complex and ever-changing London real estate market. Our digital marketplace provides informative and educational content from industry leaders through podcasts and videos. We cover various aspects of the real estate experience, including buying and selling, finance, law, tax, construction, design, and more. Join us as we delve into the latest trends and developments in the market and gain valuable insights from our panel of experts.
Hello and welcome to London Property, the home of Super Prime. I am your host, Farnaz Fazaipour, and we're delighted to welcome Justin Bennett from LBB Chartered Surveyors and Catherine Simpson from Edwin Co. back to the show, talking about a topic that is very hot at the moment, which is the leasehold reform. Now, the last time we had a conversation about this, it was about to be heard in the House of Commons, correct? So let's talk about, for our listeners who haven't listened to the previous interview, then they should probably do that. But we'll start with, it went to the House of Commons at the beginning of March.
And it's today having its second reading in the House of Lords.
So now we're towards the end of March and it's going to the House of Lords. So let's talk about what actually was achieved or not achieved in the first hearing at the House of Commons. So what would you say were the big surprises for you?
Well, what was noticeable was what actually didn't make it into the first draft of the bill, which was the abolition of leasehold houses, which was always promised. That has now made it in as a whole new Section 1 with certain exceptions. So it's not a total ban on leasehold houses.
Right. And before we got on camera, you mentioned that where there is an exception is if you build a house on a leasehold land.
Yes. So now you have permitted leases, which can be prescribed under statute or ratified by the tribunals. But there is a form of self-certification as well. But there are quite hefty fines for creating leasehold houses. And my understanding of what is being proposed, that if you breach the obligation of, if you grant a lease of a house, which isn't permitted, the lease will remain in place, but the freehold will be off at minimum cost to the leaseholder to put them in a position that they would have been. And I think the idea behind the permitted leases is the fact that once you have these houses, they are then become capable of enfranchisement, so people can then, in circumstances where the properties couldn't be built because of a leasehold piece of land, eventually they can get the freehold of that piece of land.
Right. So obviously, you know, there's a lot of kind of market dynamics that goes into what are the implications of some of these things coming forward. So what, just broadly speaking, when it went to the House of Commons, what would you say, I'm going to ask you both this question, so maybe from the legal point of view first and then from the valuation point of view, but what would you say are the things that look like they're unlikely to happen?
Well, the ground rent consultation has now closed, and Gove over the weekend, there was an article in the Sunday Times which said that he is, you know, pretty determined to somehow abolish, not, I think he accepts he cannot completely abolish ground rents, but not going to have a peppercorn situation. But in the Times, the article mentioned a cap at £250. I have actually heard that it may be a 0.1% of freehold value cap, and apparently he is looking to seek council's opinion on the human rights challenge, that because you're going to be wiping 40 billion off, you know, investors, you've got charities, you've got developers who have legitimate ground rent incomes, which will just be completely decimated.
It's intended to go backwards as well. It's not just moving forward.
Well, it's intended to change existing leases. So we already have the ban going forward because this has been in place since 2022. But it's talking about a retrospective change to the law.
Exactly.
It's silent on whether ground rents will immediately be capped at 0.1%, mm-hmm. or at £250, or whether it is, as drafted in the bill at the moment, it's for the purpose of valuation, you either value the existing ground rent, if it's in excess of, or you value at 0.1% on the review, which is the cap on the rent for the purpose of the valuation. that makes a drastic change in the valuation in the basis that it's proposed. That has essentially made it through Parliament to the Lords stage without any challenge whatsoever. There's been very, very few discussion points in the public domain, in any event, of the implications of the valuation proposals.
And Gove will be looking to achieve, you know, as high a possible abolition as he possibly can, but he does accept that it's not going to be a peppercorn rent. But he knows he's going to face challenge, which is why he's looking at, you know, the human rights balance. It's all about proportionality. I mean, the thing I find slightly surprising about the whole ground rent thing, I think there's been a lot of drama and sort of, I would call the word hysteria about it. But of course, this is where I think the whole legislation began back in 2017, was what we call the Taylor Wimpey scandal. Yeah. Of people having, you know, being sold leasehold houses. They didn't know they had leasehold houses, some of them, they claim, with, you know, onerous, very onerous doubling ground rents. And also provisions in the leases, which meant landlords could charge them ridiculous amounts of money for basically hanging up a picture. And I think there is a little bit of a danger with conflating the sort of service charge issues with ground rents. Because when I typically, you know, I'll get a call from somebody who wants to extend their lease, and, you know, we'll do a quick online calculation to how much it's going to cost. And I'll say to them, oh, how much is your ground rent? And they don't even know. So that tells me that it's not a big issue. They'll say, oh, something like £200, which I think we accept isn't an onerous ground rent. But I think there's a slight danger to see that most people aren't troubled by the ground rent. So to decimate it and then destroy, you know, charities, other investors who have legitimate ground rent portfolios seems to be madness and totally disproportionate.
On that subject, you were referring to a Knight Frank study about the financial impact of such a thing.
Oh, yeah, the Knight Frank research that was published along with a university, and excuse me, but I can't remember the name of the university, it essentially says that the impact of the proposals, not so much the ground rent, but the overall proposals, will on average increase leasehold property prices by around 10%, which will then have the knock-on effect of wiping, making it even more difficult for first-time buyers to get into the market. But the ground rent issue itself is one where, you know, there are easy ways to curtail this. I don't see why they do not just simply legislate and ban onerous ground rents, insofar as the 5, 10, 15-year doublers. Once we get into a situation where you have the 25-year review, the 33-year reviews, you're getting close in line with the government inflation targets. And these are levels that are only being reviewed every 25 or 33 years. So that in-between periods, there is no growth in the ground rent capital. And that, it could be managed in that way. So the minimum ground rent term is 25 years or 33 even. And then you're not destroying the whole industry behind it with, and all these funds that are reliant on the income. And, you know, it could be individuals who have bought their freeholds in large blocks where they've bought these freeholds because of the onerous ground rents to get themselves and the participants out of the situation, who are then locked in where they're suddenly, they're hit with picking up the tab for every other one of their neighbours who chose not to participate in the first place without compensation. It is insane, some of the proposals.
And so the bill itself is not just focusing on leasehold and ground rent, and it's got some other, I mean, on a high level basis, what are some of the other things that it's addressing? You were mentioning service charges.
Building Safety Act, service charges, even the conveyancing process to make, and with service charges to make the system more transparent, easier for tenants to get together to challenge service charges without being concerned about landlords' costs. And it also addresses landlords' costs in the enfranchisement arena. And quite controversially, is proposing to remove the obligation for tenants to pay landlords' costs in any enfranchisement claim, except in certain circumstances, which I think is another area which seems to me open for challenge, because there's no other compulsory purchase situation where a landlord has to pay bear their own costs. And what will happen is that landlords will avoid using solicitors and valuers, and the whole thing will just be chaos.
God, we don't need any more dysregulation in this industry. Yeah. It's like we're already trying to deal with all the consequences of having a whole bunch of agents with no licenses. But so tell me something else. So now it's gone through the Commons, and now what happens in the House of Lords?
So essentially the same process is going to happen in the House of Lords. So 27th March, the second reading in the House of Lords. They will then discuss the bill itself before it goes to their own committee stage, which will then go through line by line the legislation in the same way as the House of Commons did. And then it will go back to the third reading, which they will vote on their proposed amendments, which will then be sent back to the House of Commons. It is probable, I would hope, that there will be a more robust discussion around the valuation issues, which were nigh on not discussed in the House of Commons. And perhaps the 50%, now that the Act is proposing to change 25% non-residential buildings to 25% non-residential buildings being capable of enfranchisement, that will get discussed, because otherwise we're going to see drastic changes to the profile of the high streets.
So just to explain that a little bit more to our listeners, currently, if you've got a building that's got more than 25% of its entire footprint as commercial, it falls outside of the Act and you can't get the freehold.
Yeah, I mean, just to clarify the point on the non-residential is the Act is actually says non-residential, although in effect it's commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you exclude common parts in the calculation, and they're raising that 25% to 50%.
You exclude the common parts, but also you say that it's commercial, but then on the Grosvenor estate, they've got these funny leases that are 21 years, so they're considered special circumstances, so they fall outside the freehold
That's a different point. That's about making your lease not qualifying by making sure it's not a long lease. So a long lease is a lease in excess of 21 years.
Right, but then if you've got, currently, if you've got more than 25% of those type of properties, then that building falls outside being freehold. So it protects Eaton Square, mainly.
Well, no, because it still remains residential.
Yes, that would be...
It's a non-qualifying lease, but it remains residential. So it would fall into the residential category. But when it comes to calculating the number of people joining in to go for the freehold, there would be a non-qualifying lease.
It's a non-qualifying lease, that's what they call it. Okay.
Yeah.
So just to go back to that. So once you've got this raised to 50%, then the most frightening thing that could happen is you'll have high streets like Marylebone, where 50% commercial being on the ground floor now means that the flat owners upstairs can become the freeholders of these shops in the high street who know nothing about how to run retail commercial offices, but they're the freeholders and then they're calling the shots, which is in reverse when you look at big buildings where you've got 100 flats with long leases. So actually the majority of the interest falls with the leaseholder, and you've got the freeholder making the decisions who might hold 2 or 3% of the value of the building. So one way, you know, it causes a chaos in the high street, and then the other way, it's the person who has the least interest making the decision.
Essentially, it's going to be the devil's in the detail, because the leaseholders, if they collectively enfranchising, have to offer for the commercial elements. What is proposed is that there will automatically be a lease back of the commercial elements. So they will have the control of the ground floors and basements, perhaps if they're commercial, first floors, whatever. And there will be a further option that the leaseholders can elect for the freeholders to take 9-on-9-year leases back on non-participating flats. So you could have a situation where the leaseholders collectively own the freeholds, but the original freeholder then has control of individual flats within the building and of the ground floor, but with restrictions on operation of the ground floors that they never had before, which is where you will have your ad hoc ownership of high streets, but you will have the same owners controlling the commercial elements, but subject to the whims of the leaseholders who will be perhaps looking to mitigate their costs for maintenance so that You may have one beautifully maintained building, one next to one which is less well maintained. And it could just purely be because one will insist on 5-year external decorations and one will say, look, let's lift the decorations. Are fine, we will leave it for 7 years. So instead of high streets being decorated in one go, they will be decorated at different times. So you'll walk down the streets and there'll be scaffold on one building, something going on another. So you won't have these clean parades of shops that you find in these central London locations
now. So potentially our high streets are going to be decimated and, you know, in the hands of basically amateurs. And there is also an issue, I think, about, many lenders actually don't like lending on flats in commercial above shops. They don't lend. And so it may actually affect the marketability and mortgageability of flats, knowing that, you know, you've got a building that's in the hands of people who simply don't know how to run commercial premises.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit here, because basically we're used to the Grosvenor owning 500 acres and the Cadogan owning 200 acres and, you know, whatever of prime central London. But there is the flip side, which in Europe, presumably, the high streets are not owned by big landlords. I don't know enough about it to say with certainty, but, you know, they seem to have some pretty nice streets that seem to work. So there's got to be a layer of something you can do, although it sounds crazy to put, an asset in the hands of people whose business is not to run retail.
It will certainly disincentivize developers who will have to reset their parameters when they're building these sorts of things on the high street. They will look to increase the commercial so that it's over 50%, and therefore they'll be reducing the residential stock. So we'll have a situation where our housing stock is depleted, which was certainly never what the government intended.
Well, it's the only thing the government intends to do is to increase housing. Exactly. But then again, at the same time, all the things that happen
affordable
actually reduce housing.
Yeah, affordable housing for all, and that is totally contrary.
Right, that's a very good point.
But that's one of the issues with the reducing the one-off transfer from the freeholder to the existing leaseholder with the reduction in the premium, that going forward, that person who has the flat now will either sell it at a higher price or will take advantage, or it will be a situation of the leases will be extended and the resale will be at a higher price. So you will remove this ability for somebody to enter into a market. You know, I could say, I would love to live in Queensgate, but I can't afford a 100-year lease on a flat in Queensgate, but I can afford a 10-year lease. So I can go into Queensgate in my 10-year lease, elect to maybe perhaps hope that the market rises, sell it in 3 or 4 years' time, get my money back, move on, let the next person go in. All of a sudden, that property, instead of being worth perhaps 25% of the value, suddenly is worth 50% of the value of the 100-year lease. So that prices me out immediately. And, you know, so you can take that into any part of the country. It can be in the Midlands. The economics will be different, but the principle will be the same.
But these leases have to actually reduce first. So we're in most cases, 70, 80 years away from that.
But when you look at the costing for the removal of marriage value is, give or take, 25 billion. That is all on leases that are below 80 years. And that potentially doesn't account for the ones which will fall into the below 80-year category beforehand. Effectively, you're moving the fact that marriage value is ignored in the current legislation at over 80 years, which it wasn't when the legislation was originally enacted. You're moving that to marriage value is ignored at all times, regardless of whether it exists.
Now, can I ask a really basic question here? Why do we have to deal with it by marriage value, and why can't we just deal with it by just valuation?
Well, it is valuation.
Well, it is, but why can't we just say that, you know, take away that marriage bit?
Because marriage value is inherent in property value.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. The amount in the real world, marriage value is something that exists. An investor will buy a building in the hope of obtaining possession of it in a certain period of time, will take rent income on that building for that period of time. It can be a shop on a high street, it can be an office building. But essentially, if he's buying something that is already on a long lease, he is buying something for the income and for the reversion in the future. He will, in the residential market, we use the Sportelli rates to discount. And, you know, so we know when we enter this valuation what it is. The fact that we're using 5% for flats and 4.75% for houses, in reality, inflates the value of what those were. Because, you know, when those rates were set, the markets were much more different. But in any event, there is, the landlord has an interest. And that's reflected in what becomes the marriage value. Marriage value is simply comparing what both people have afterwards with what both people have before. And the valuation of both interests is different. When you total either sides of the equation, what the difference is the marriage value.
Except that it's not, because you're paying half of it.
Well, you're keeping half and they're getting half.
Shared. I think one very basic way of looking at marriage value is, and people often use this analogy, is you've got two vases, one in the freeholder's hand, one in the leaseholder's hand. So they both have a value of their own, but they're more valuable when they're put together.
Got it.
So it's about the coalescence of those two interests. So when you enfranchise as a leaseholder and you get your freehold or your long lease, you're coalescing the value and then you share it between you.
I mean, in reality, it's no different to a ransom strip of plot of land. You have a plot here where you want to build your house, but there's a pathway here where which you can't get to your piece of land. So that land has an increase in value, which is how much more are both plots worth because of merging them together. You merge those two interests together, you have a marriage value and you agree to split the difference.
Now, so we're going to go to the House of Lords. It's going to go to a committee afterwards, go back to the House of Commons. So as experts, and you know, we should say this at the beginning or at the end, but just a little bit about how much you've been involved in this whole process before we answer the next question. You've been following it quite closely. You've actually made some comments towards the proposed papers.
Yeah, but I put evidence into the House of Commons on what I thought was the implication of this bill and what could have been done far more simply.
Yeah.
You know, and going back to marriage value, it was remove the statutory assumption that you're the only lease in the market that can't extend your lease.
So my question is, having been so hands-on and involved in this process, both of you as professionals, you know, from a legal perspective and a valuation perspective, what do you fear is going to be the result of this whole process?
For me, it's that there is no change to the proposed valuation basis.
You think that might end up happening?
Well, it went through the whole House of Commons with probably four questions raised in public domain on the valuation.
That's what I found actually quite alarming watching the Select Committee, which is, you know, valuers were invited to give evidence and were really asked very little. And there was an awful lot of airtime given to, yes, those who'd suffered at the hands of developers and leasehold houses, huge amount of airtime, but really no detail.
The concentration was on service charge.
The conversation was certainly on service charges, which is an area that needs reform. But the enfranchisement, the easier and cheaper bit, will be achieved through the standard valuation method.
Yeah, there are ways of simplifying it to make it cheaper without the controversy. And it's only this weekend past where it's been brought into the public domain by the nationwide press.
So it sounds like the bits that are very press-worthy are the bits that they're being focused upon. But, you know, the really technical stuff that really needs to be addressed is the parts that no one's really giving any attention to.
Yes, and it's now, because it's come out in the press, that suddenly the government's taking interest in it and the MPs are taking more interest in it. And perhaps when it goes back, having been it through the Lords and through the Lords Committee, it will go back with amendments to the basis of valuation that may lead to the government having a rethink, or it could just merely be that they put through all the non-controversial parts like an immediate qualification. There's no need for the two-year wait other than to make it more expensive. So that can easily be removed. the 990, they can keep that. They can keep the notion that the property is sold in terms of the valuation itself based on a 990-year lease, which is the most the freeholder would ever get for it in the first place, because the freeholder, immediately that they sell the lease, lose the additional 1% that they have.
So thank you very much for joining us again, and we will be certain to have you back after the legislation's gone through the House of Lords and back to the Commons. So hopefully we will be able to take some more of your time up then. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, if you have got any questions to do with the legal side or the valuation side of the Leasehold Reform Act, then do please get in touch. As you can see, we speak to leading experts about the subject, and we'd be delighted to hear from you to give you a guiding hand.
Thanks for tuning in to our latest episode of the London Property Podcast. Head over to our website where you can browse our exclusive network of top experts driving the market. As a member, you'll have direct access to our experts and their networks. Our award-winning content will help you choose the right professionals for your needs and make informed decisions about your investments. Personal recommendations are a powerful tool in connecting with trusted professionals. Let us introduce you to the right people to help you achieve your real estate goals. Contact us now to learn more about becoming a member and gaining access to these valuable resources, or joining our directory of experts.